In this episode of the Ownership Economy podcast, Jahed and I sat down with Luke Weber, founder of Collectivo and a core contributor to PrimeDAO. This is the first episode in what will be a series on Web3 meets climate solutions. We plan to delve into topics of natural capital, regenerative finance, resource accounting, and ecosystem services. With Luke, we extended the conversations we had in episode 15 with David Casey on local resilient economies and episode 13 with Dr. Sean Conway on impact markets. We hope you enjoy the episode.
All right. Thanks for joining us today, Luke. We usually start these things off by just asking you to give us a bit of an intro, give an intro to the audience. So basically, you know, Carter, you can start wherever you like, as far back as you like. I think for the purposes of this one, we are definitely interested in Curaçao and your backstory. So feel free to go as far back as you like.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm super excited to jump in. I was born and raised on the small Caribbean island of Curaçao, which is kind of an important part of my whole life. I grew up there about half of my youth, spent the other half of my life in the Netherlands, started off studying philosophy and business administration, a double degree, which already from kind of that starting point really made me think a lot about the meaning of business, meaning of life, kind of why am I doing all this? I have a background in martial arts as well, did a lot of karate for the majority of my life, which also often challenged the cultural norms of the island of Curaçao with the more kind of Eastern philosophy, and then that mixed up with the Dutchness in me often made me think about about certain aspects of society, of life, which is also eventually what got me into crypto. For the past 5 years, I've been mainly ecosystem building, been in Web3 now since 2016, been having a good time.
Nice. I think like some of the stuff in your background that I think plays into the both crypto, finance, all that is pretty important. So I think, you know, you're one of the more diverse people in the space. You started out in asset management, right? Like early in your career, right?
I think even before that, I did a bunch of organization and events. That's maybe a part of me that not a lot of people knew, but I used to run blockchain talks in the Netherlands back in 2017, 18, 19. Used to be part of the core team. We used to organize meetups around the Netherlands talking about blockchain. This is also where I met some amazing people like Ethicup, for example, like 4 or 5 years ago. In these smaller meetups, ran that for about 2 years, also ran the Caribbean Blockchain Network already back in 2018 in the Caribbean. And eventually from 19 onwards, I started both founding DAOs myself after spinning out kind of this DAO stack ecosystem, and later on became a researcher and followed up by becoming an asset manager. Ran in 2021, ran a DeFi fund from the Amsterdam Stock Exchange. And a year prior to that was running as an analyst at a crypto fund.
Got it. So like, and I feel like all of that then plays into, you know, what this series is about. Because we really talk about, you know, you mentioned the ownership economy. We have a more specific definition of that. Really, for us, it's just it's the space between market and state that's really being, that's combining elements of both that then is kind of rebuilding a commons that's letting people have more broad-based ownership, broad-based governance, right? And the interplay between ownership and governance. And so going back to, you know, the beginning of your story, right? Curaçao plays a bigger role in this and this ownership economy notion. So I wanted to focus on this early refi phase. Maybe we call it early refi in Curaçao. So there's a lot of stuff you've done even before we get into the DAO stuff with CuraDAO, CuraDai, and local money systems. And that stuff has been a big theme of the pod. We talked about it with David Casey at Resource Network. We dove into all the specifics around that. So maybe you could take us back to the beginning of that journey, right? Tell us a bit about the beginning of your refi journey relative to CuraDai and Curaçao.
Yeah, and thanks for giving kind of the wrap up, because I was super curious to hear your definition of it. And to me, ownership economy, I believe I actually made an account with that name like 4 years ago. I think to me, these two concepts are like, especially together, mean a lot. I got a lot of my early influence when I just got involved into DAOs from Systems Innovation, which was kind of a network organization movement doing innovation stuff. And I also spoke a lot about ownership, about networks, about what. So for me, this really started, like I mentioned, with the Caribbean Blockchain Network, which was a movement we started back when I was still in my final years of university and with fellow students to have a positive impact on the Caribbean by leveraging blockchain. We didn't know how, what, why, when. And we just knew that these values and systems that blockchains enable seemed extremely promising to bring back power to people, especially some of these key things that we may take for given now in blockchains are culturally or like value-wise very different from the systems we're used to in the Caribbean, especially. think of transparency, think of reliability, of digital nativeness, kind of a lot of things in the Caribbean are still run through people and paper. You talk to someone that then gives you a stamp, that then talk to someone else that gives you a stamp. So these systems are very manual and paper-based. And then, you know, when we started to realize that, hey, there must be something special in these new technologies and this new way of seeing the world. Early 2018, we got in touch with Patrick Rawson, who was back then the ecosystem lead for DAOSEC, one of the first three DAO platforms. And they issued a grant to the Caribbean Blockchain Network to research the potential of decentralized governance for small nations. That research came out as expected, that nepotism takes away a chunk of the value of these smaller economies. And it also, by taking away the value, it also decreases the opportunities for all the other people. And it leads to a bigger inequality gap, and it leads to less ecosystem services and whatso. And it really trickles down to kind of every layer of society in these small economies. So from there, we organized the Curaçao Blockchain Week in 2019. We brought together about 60, 70 people from the island, but also some people that were part of DAOSTEC. And we started to imagine what it would look like if the community leveraged these tools for their own benefit. That's how we started CuraDAO, which was a social impact grants giving organization run by 60 community members. Everybody was 60. Issued. Yeah, 60. And this was back in the times when there were no decentralized exchanges, when there was no, it was very primitive. So we had a dApp, we onboarded people into MetaMask, we sent them their first 0.1 or 0.2 ETH, which back then was like $3 or something.
Beautiful.
And from, yeah, that's a good times, right? And from those 60 people, eventually about 20, 25 actually participated actively. Most of those people got Uniswap airdrops and what's afterwards. So they were rewarded handsomely Amazing. For their early involvement. But during these pilots, we already started to realize that this is just a small tip of the iceberg that we're touching. Giving grants in a more transparent way, giving funding is one piece of this puzzle, but there's a way bigger puzzle to solve. During the early times, we already had this small group called Youth for Climate, which was a local movement of primarily teens doing climate activism on the island. And they came to CuraDAO to request a small grant, like $200. And I asked them, why are you coming to this weird, scary crypto thingy for funding? Are there so many other alternatives on the ground? And they said, because nobody asked us what we needed to do what we think is important. And that's one of the pieces that really stuck to me and motivated me to keep going, because we found something that there are people that are wanting to do good right now. But because of the setup of the system or the culture, whatever reason, they're currently unable to get the support they needed. So they were working with the government and everything, but on their terms, on the terms of the government or the terms of the nonprofit. But never were they asked, what do you think is important? How do you want to take it? What do you want to do?
Yeah.
So that was a big part of this. There's a realization that we need systems that empower those people. We need to value what they're doing. From there, our minds started to continue to evolve kind of into understanding how would this evolve and what do we need? Because one of the biggest challenges with the specific group, Youth for Climate, was not the MetaMask, was not the voting, was not the project. The hardest part was that we had to pay them with Ethereum, that they were unable to off-ramp locally. So then we had to do like 4 or 5 steps to finally get them their currency. And when they got that money, it was worth only 80% of what they requested because the price of ETH dumped. And out of all the things that we dumped onto them, kind of all the newness, this was the part that confused them. The why is this money not the money that I requested anymore? Why is it going up and down? Why can't I just spend it? And this was really what triggered us to also start looking into currencies more and more and researching the current community currencies that are already around, going into conversation with early groups like MakerDAO to understand what a community currency could look like.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's pause there. I wanted to circle back on this because us Web3 folks, we get into a lot of this stuff around technological solutionism, where we're just talking about how sick our solutions are. I love how you really trace the arc to how you got to them, right? There was a lot of learnings on there, right? I think one thing that'd be interesting to circle back on is, you know, regardless of where people are coming to on the pod, I think it's important to call out, like, what are the, you mentioned things like, you know, paper bureaucracy, I don't think you use primitive with risk. You were using that word with respect to something else, more just like, you know, you have these sort of archaic systems that the Curaçao and maybe other island economies are running on. What are the other sorts of problems that you see when you guys came together and said, you know what was the real driving factor? You just say, we have to go and do something with blockchain. in our home island, right? What are the problems that you saw that you think really said, this is an opportunity?
Yeah, so it's really the inefficiencies in coordination as a whole. So it's not just on the permit level, it's also on the financing level. Local initiatives do not get funding. Local banking systems are slow and not as international as what we're used to, for example, here in Europe or in the States. We still, till this day, I think only 20-30% of the island has a credit card or an equivalent that they can make international purchases. The vast majority either does not have a bank account or has a bank account that's limited to the local currency. That was an important chunk. And I think kind of everything that comes with it is that we have this brain drain happening on the island where, because of those conditions, because the system isn't set up for people to thrive, because it isn't set up for you with a lot of talent to kind of get most out of it. I've seen so many people go to the island, just get destroyed by the system and then go crazy or go back to another country and just say, I'm never going back to that place ever again. But they love the people, they love the food, they love the culture, they love the island, they love everything there. It's just the system that made them quit and leave. So it's really a combination of all these things that make that society and culture as a whole is just less productive there. And when you kind of, when I'm saying productive, it's not just financial, but also, for example, ecological. The average person on the island does not have enough of a, I wouldn't call it self-love, but they don't have enough of a respect towards the outside world or the system that they, for example, don't litter. Everybody litters. Eat your food, you literally throw it out of your car. Nobody cares. Who cares? What are they going to do? It becomes this almost like negative sum game. You're like, what can I win from throwing it in a garbage can? That's something that rich people do. I don't do that. I just throw it out of the window. So there's a lot of things, but I think it all comes down to these economies, these systems not set being set up for people to thrive.
Got it. And then so people for it not being set up for the people themselves to drive. You mentioned this as well. This is a common theme on the pod too. Sean Conway from IXO really mentioned this in that he, you know, spent 10, 15 years in impact working with the UN, the World Economic Forum, the UK government. And the one thing that stood out to him was this thing, basically this idea that, you know, he heard the word co-design of an intervention maybe once or twice, right? And now it's becoming a bit more common, but you know, 15 years ago, not at all, right? So you backed into this as well when you're talking about how the co-design of these interventions with these kids that came to you for a $200 grant, right? They were like, well, you guys were the first ones to ask us what we actually wanted to do, right? So tell us a bit more about that. How did that kind of spark your current direction?
Yeah, and I think it relates back to this ownership economy idea, right? So they wanted to participate meaningfully in the economy. They wanted to create value. They wanted to help the island, but they lacked the infrastructure. They weren't able to open a bank account because they were under 18. They weren't able to be taken serious because of that, because it's like, hey, you can't even have money. What are you going to do? And through conversations with them, and it was really just 2-3 calls to get them through the whole process of one, explaining what CurioDAO was, the second call, getting them a MetaMask, and the third call, reviewing their proposal and voting on it and passing it through. Every step down the road, we realized more and more that this is so important, but also how much there is to solve, because they would bring up new things, right? Like I mentioned with Ethereum going up and down, which was really the part that sparked the need for a community currency, because we realized that if the value in our system is not something that the average person, and even the more educated people, because these were pretty educated, smart kids, if not even they can understand this money that we're using or this value that we're transferring, then how can we expect the bigger majority of the island to benefit from this? Because that is such a kind of topic, like a topic that's so hard to discuss in this space, right? Because the people that we need to help most are the people that don't have access to what we're creating most of the time. We're primarily English natives. We're doing everything digital in a very fast pace. And this is also something, maybe jumping ahead a little bit, but as we're designing our apps now, we also need to be mindful of those things, because if we truly want to impact the whole, we need to make sure it is accessible to not just the well-educated, but the whole community. And so that engagement with these youths really reminded us that if we want to make a system that enables people to thrive, we need to make it inclusive, and we need to make it in a way that everybody, regardless of age, gender, race, or whatever, as long as you're aligned to this bigger vision, to these same values, you should be able to play the game with us.
Got it. I think, like, I want to go back a little bit, because you keep talking about interesting stuff, interesting threads that I wanted to dive into some more. So I think one you mentioned is, you know, Ethereum dumped when you made this grant. So they're like, oh, I don't understand this and all that. So I want to ask you, at that point, why wouldn't you guys, did you guys consider something like, hey, this island economy is already pegged in many ways to the dollar, right? Like things are exported in the dollar. Your local currency is probably then, you know, but you can, your purchasing power is pegged from your local currency against the dollar. Why not just give them USDC stablecoins or something? What was your thought process around that, right? Because you could launch your own DAI. You could do, like, DAI existed, right? So why back into making your own local currency? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's an important, I think that's a really good point. So the Curaçao guilder, the Antillean guilder, is backed to the US dollar with a fixed rate. The central bank needs to maintain at least 19% of US dollar in collateral, and then we can have Curaçao guilders. So already early on, our first kind of our first necessity for this community currency was for it to be stable or relatively stable. We could not have that it loses 10, 20% in a week. It's not something we can sell to people, right? Nobody wants that. So that's where we started to dive deep into DAI because of blockchain talks and knew Wouter from Makers. It was like, hey, let's have a chat. Let's sit down and imagine what this could be. But then we realized that kind of when we started to use DAI, we realized that DAI was still very confusing to people. The naming is weird. It took a lot of convincing to explain to them that, hey, this is almost like a US dollar. And we realized that there's also a big cultural aspect to money that we cannot just ignore. Being able to pay with a currency, like a physical banknote that has your spirit animal on it, makes you proud, makes you feel like, hey, yeah, this is my money. This is my community. And that's where we started to work on CuraDai, which essentially was just a wrapper of DAI. You would take one DAI, it would allow you to mint 1.78 CuraDai, but it had a couple of benefits for it. So one, it kept the local accounting system for locals. So they no longer had to calculate in their mind, is $3 a lot or not that much? Is it a great price or a bad price? So we kept it to their own accounting system, which helps in valuing things, whether it's volunteer work or products. Second, we added a physical, like a visual cultural element to it. So we used the colors and style of Curaçao. So people felt more that, hey, this is Curaçao related. Even put it Cura in the name. So people are like, oh, Cura something. And finally, we also then created our own data set, because if it was just DAI, it would have been really hard to understand the size of the Curaçao DAI economy, let's say.
Yeah.
And so by having CuraDai, we're able to get a better understanding of the community because we had our own kind of subset of data. And finally, we also had a small revenue model, because every time someone minted CuraDai, they were paying 178. And then to get it back, you had to pay 1.5% more to extract it back into DAI. So that was also a nice experiment. So those things together kind of led to us, yeah, making those decisions.
Cool. So now, if we're following along, then you have a local money, a local currency experiment. Your, maybe one of the aims is, you know, you, if you're using the USD guilder with the USD backed guilder, in some way, you're going to be paying rent on your purchasing power to the US government and its printing, which is mm-hmm. fine, right? Like, fine when times are okay. What has it been like, you know, when you think about this ownership economy? One of the things that's attractive to us is this idea of being able to have access to broad-based distribution of wealth by broadly expanding governance rights, right? And so by including more people in this, when you think of something like 2020 and the economy mm-hmm. since then, right? How has that actually progressed for your folks, your people on the ground? What has that been like?
Yeah, 2020 really was the year that everything changed, where our mind shifted from just CuraDAO and CuraDai as a cool experiment to, hey, we are, maybe we're actually onto something here. I think there are three things that happened that really changed our minds. Number one is, prior to 2020, everything we did was under the Satoshi mindset of, I need to keep it hidden. One day I need to disappear. I should not talk about this. Maybe kind of the next, like this generation of people don't have that same sensation. But back in 2020, I would even say, and prior, crypto was a little bit of a secret thing. You were afraid that if I spoke about it too loud, people would rob me, or that people like... So there was this thing that was holding us back of talking about this even, because we felt we may get sued, we may get attacked. 2020 really was a tipping point, because the island of Curaçao currently mainly relies on tourism. Our economy has been declining for the past 10 years. We used to have Venezuela as a big oil business partner of the island. We used to run a big refinery on our island. That hasn't been the case for almost half a decade now. So our economy is already declining, and then COVID hit, and our only final pillar of the economy, tourism, got completely destroyed. So what happened on the island was that we had a crazy amount of unemployment. From, I think we went from 23 to 40 something percent unemployment, which is just insane. And on top of that, the government, the central bank, were running out of money. Again, we don't have the luxury to print our own money. We need the US dollars, so then we can make guilders. So the island ended up taking a loan from the Netherlands to be able to survive. And that came with some conditions. We had to give up some autonomy. We had to give up certain aspects to get that basically survival money. So this was all kind of triggers. It was like, crap, we really need to make this happen. This is no longer a nice to have, but something that we may want to do as a fun experiment. This is something critical that Curaçao and other countries need if we want to thrive in decades to come. And then some good things happened. So first, we participated in the Innovaton of the Ministry of Economic Development in Curaçao. And this was the first time we called it Colectivo. We were just like, hey, we take Curaçao and we take Curaçao, we slap it on top of each other, and then we can create like an impact machine. We presented it and we won the competition. And I was shocked. I asked the judges, are you aware of what I'm saying? Do you understand I'm trying to make a complementary economy? And they said, yes, and that's why we voted for you.
Wow.
We don't understand what, why, how, but this looks extremely promising. And that gave us the first kind of legitimization of our concept on the ground, that we don't have to be afraid that the government is trying to lock us in jail or that anybody is going to try to destroy us, as long as we are transparent and open and try to get it right thing. So for me, that was a big mental switch of trying to do this hidden to being able to do it for real. That same week, we got our first grant from MakerDAO to support the further development of CuraDAO, which was another kind of trigger of like, hey, we're on the right track. And also around that time was the time when I started working more closely with Patrick Rawson from Curve Labs, and we started applying further grants, and we started to really look further at what this could become. And part of that was the agroforestry movement that was coming up on Curaçao was starting to flirt with us.
Yeah.
Which I think is something we can dive into, and I would love to dive into that. So
yeah,
I have a couple of fun stories there.
Okay, yeah, so before you get into it, I like to frame it a little bit, right? So like, let's get into, you know, I'll put these in the show notes, right? But for folks who haven't really dug into this too much, right? There was a great piece put out by Union Square Ventures about a year and a half ago on natural asset tokenization, right? And in that piece, they go through some of the stuff around, well, first of all, what does that mean? What is it? Why would we do it? And you folks are doing it, but I'll just to set up the background a little bit, right? There's anywhere, depending on which economist you ask and which literature you're looking at, there's anywhere from like $16 to $54 trillion of input to the global economy from ecosystem services, right? So that involves all the things that we, you know, the air quote fingers for those who can't see us, ecosystem services, right? That's the air we breathe, carbon we sequester, you know, food, the watershed health, ocean carbon sequestration, everything you think of, right? And try to slap a price on it. And so when you're talking about agroforestry, you know, there, that's it's its own separate movement, but you know, you can then actually say for the purposes of potentially making it more efficient or turning it its impact towards a particular goal, you can say, what if we tokenize a particular tract of land, used a various set of MRV technologies, measurement, reporting, and verification tech, to basically say we took a certain type of action on this land. This was its ecological state as measured by MRV in a couple of different ways. And now we want to actually see what that group has done so that the group who is stewarding this piece of land can potentially be paid for not simply harvesting its resources, like cutting all of its trees down or growing its fruit or what have you, but actually taking other actions that can be priced that are positive, right? So having said all that mouthful, I wanted to avoid you having to do all that part, just to give you the setup. And so part of the series we're doing now then, to come back around to it, is this idea of regenerative finance. And for me, it stands out in at least two ways with respect to what you guys do, which is number one, we already talked about, non-extractive, potentially local currency systems, right? They don't, doesn't necessarily all have to be local currency systems, but local currency systems seem to fit within that. And then the other piece is what we'll get into now, tokenized natural assets and regenerative economics, right? So tell us a bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, thanks for that good summary. I think that's extremely helpful. I think one common theme with agroforestry and that, and this is really where it started for me, was understanding this common theme of doing things as nature, of approaching things as the complex systems that they are and flowing with energy over control. This concept, I think we have mechanized a lot of the world over the past decades, past centuries. We've tried to squeeze things into boxes where oftentimes those things shouldn't be boxes. And one aspect where you really see that is with agriculture. We've really tripled down as we grew as economies. We wanted more and more and more. We've tripled down on monoculture, which is essentially just planting one specific crop across a big terrain of land. But what it does to the terrain is it's degenerative. It destroys the land. You need to plow the land. You need to change the land. It's essentially extracting ecological value out of the earth to produce these monolithic, these simple crops fast for mass production. And I first met Roland van Reyne, who is one of the pioneers when it comes to centropic forestry, centropic agriculture, all those things. That was back in 2020. He also used to run a common supermarket in the Netherlands. So he's really coming from this kind of collective mindset. And it first started really clicking on this philosophical system, like we're approaching things as nature. We're looking at bigger systems. We're looking at the holes. We're looking to redivide. And from there, started to understand more and more the potential of these ecological, these natural systems to create value, and that they are currently greatly undervalued. And that started really this whole pathway into natural assets and understanding what they are. Food forest or agroforestry is the best natural asset right now for the island of Curaçao, because we have a big need of food. We are a small island. Majority of our food comes from imports. The average price of an apple, one single apple, can be up to $3 on the island, with the average salary being around, I think the minimum is like $800, $600-$700 a month. So people that have minimum wage will never be able to eat an apple on Curaçao because of the current system. So agroforestry food systems really were the point where we all said, hey, this is something that we need more of. And how can we get more of those? And we started to have conversations with the agroforestry community on the island, who are already being supported partially by the government as well, who flew in some experts from Brazil. So we had an initial community going on, and we started to understand better and better that, yeah, this just brings extreme value to the island, but there's still a lot of limitations holding back, yeah, our people being able to rely on agroforestry for their food. Because it's not just the food, right? With that, you restore the ground, you sequestrate CO2, you also have a community aspect to it, because people that previously were unemployed are now able to contribute to something meaningful. They can share, they can give, they can learn, which is a part that I think we often forget, but there's a whole human side behind this natural systems as well.
Question for you before you get into the human side. Sorry, I was like, oh man, he's on a good roll. But I had a question for you, to getting back a bit to the agroforestry, right? Why do it as a DAO, or why involve any of the tools that Collectiva does, right? Because there are people who do, there's a guy from Kernel, who I'll probably have on Gitcoin's Kernel program, who I met, who is doing agroforestry in Brazil, and he's been doing it for like 20 years, right? And so like, what is the reason that we would want to bring in any of the tools that you guys built, right? You have stuff like geospatial NFTs, you've got all these, I can get really jargony, right? But where is the overlap, right? Because I could just go today and find an agroforestry group on the internet and Facebook or something. I could go out and buy a tract of land, I could do it, right? Where do the Web3 tools come in?
I think it's organization and the efficiencies that come from it. So as it is right now, we have a bunch of agroforestry groups, but they aren't as organized as they're not formal organizations. And therefore, there's a lot of knowledge and resources that is not being distributed across a larger network. On the island of Curaçao, a big kind of blocker is finance. Those smaller communities do not have the finance, knowledge, network, and skills themselves to scale this up to 1,000 forests, for example. So this whole blockchain and Web3 really comes in to facilitate these frameworks for them to coordinate through, to become more effective at accomplishing what they want to accomplish, which is really also where this community, complementary community currency comes in, why tokenizing some of that value in these geo NFTs, we can dive a little bit deeper into that in a bit, why that's so crucial, because we need to open up more pathways for these people to be to be able to do what they do, but keep doing it better, because otherwise we're not ever going to be able to rely on these systems for the whole population or a good chunk of it. We need to be able to make it scalable, make it trustworthy, make it, yeah, run almost like a business, but it needs to run because it's going to be such a critical piece of the island.
This is an interesting theme that I think we hit on with all the impact folks that we have thus far talked to on our show, is that they've come out of maybe a half a decade or more of experience trying to do impact work that's purely nonprofit or driven by a, you know, policy framework from some NGO or what have you. And they realize that actually some kind of market-based focus or a way for us to make a market that can price things is key. So are you kind of basically saying that that's something you backed into? Because from a key thesis for me has always been that with natural assets, so, you know, let's say a river and the land that it runs through, if you buy it as a DAO and you tokenize the river's assets itself, you could potentially discover the price of that if you're able to have a global market that had found a way to price water, clean water that comes as a service from land, right? So the two things for me at the end of the day, I shouldn't have picked a river, by the way, because I was going to say one is price discovery and the other one is liquidity, right? So it's just a bad example, I think, of rivers and liquidity, but I'll deal with that. That's my problem. So is that something that you're basically saying that you guys, you know, have with the ability to tokenize, you would have the ability to price the services from the people who are doing this stuff to make it more profitable for them such that they can potentially have more wealth generated locally and then not have to worry about paying $3 for an apple?
100%. Yeah, exactly that. So it's really valuing things that are valuable to people in a better way, creating ways for that value to be passed around. Opens up these markets that previously didn't exist, that should have existed already for a long time. But I think only now through our development in vision on the world, in technological developments, we are coming to the point where we can actually accomplish this or try to accomplish this. I think one meme, or I don't even know if it's a meme, but one thing that I always tell people if I need to convince them like 10 seconds why this should be valuable is United Nations, kind of the world, the power, the people in power, have set one big agenda. It's an impact agenda, sustainable development goals, 2030. It's now 2022 and we're super extremely far off. It's only a matter of time until creating impact will become the number one priority of the whole world. And then we want systems that can do that in a fair and efficient way. And that's really something that I've grown to believe more and more, that we have maybe 3-4 years to make these systems work. Because there will be a point where I think the majority of all resources on the planet will want to go to some sort of impact regeneration direction, simply because we have all promised that we want to accomplish that, but we're not. And therefore, we need those markets to exist and experiment with those markets now, because in 3-4 years, it will be too late. If we then need to invent the wheel, if we then need to understand how these systems work and be priced, we're never, ever going to reach these targets. But also more importantly, we'll probably have destroyed Earth to the point that there's no return, which is another maybe final reason why these small islands are really our first focus, because they'll be the ones that will disappear first if we continue doing what we're doing.
Got it. Now, it's interesting, you know, when you talk markets in this space too, one of the common things, this just happened to me the other day, so I'm interested in your take on it, right? I won't name the parties, but we were in a discussion about monitoring ecological state with MRV measurement reporting and verification technology, so that, you know, and this is stuff that's been around for 25 years at least, since you've had the initial, you know, gold standard Vera, those folks who stood up this class for carbon credits, right? But we were talking about this idea of natural asset tokenization so that price discovery and other, you know, things could come to play, so that we can actually say, did a market in improving a watershed that drains into the ocean into a fishery, did it actually do what it was supposed to do, right? And people are like, well, I don't know, are you folks, and this is coming from a government person, right? They're like, it seems like we are financializing everything, right? So has that been something that, you know, you folks, the Colectivo, have worked with governments, right? The island of Curaçao government is ostensibly on your side. They really love what you're doing. I've seen some of the press releases. What has that conversation been like for people who are like, ooh, tokenization, ooh, financialization of resources. Wow, who's going to own it? Like, oh, that sounds bad. How's that conversation been for you?
Hard, but interesting. I wouldn't say they're completely on our side. I think they have accepted that this is something worth experimenting. But at the same note, the central bank, for example, did send out a warning. Hey, we haven't regulated this thing, which is okay. It shows at least that they're aware and that they acknowledge and that they are also honestly saying we haven't given formal buy this yet. And I think that comes back from kind of what you're describing. Are we going to financialize everything? And I think that more important question, who's going to own this? I think fits this podcast really well. I'm convinced that if we create a model that proves to have a net positive impact on people and is regenerative to society. And for me, that concept of regenerative, the core piece to me is that with every feedback loop, with every interaction, you create more positive conditions for future prosperity, which, for example, means that with every cycle of Collectivo Gilder, we create a smaller inequality gap, for example, or we increase the average education level of the island. And things like that are regenerative by nature, because every time you do that, you also increase the capability of the system to thrive. So what we're trying to do is move the conversation away from so only the financial part, because we're definitely valuing more things than previously. That is because we have a broader understanding today about value than we had 10, 20, 50 years ago. I do think that there's a side note there that there will be a point where we reach kind of a point where it's too much. But I don't think we aim to do that either. Like, let's imagine, like, I just had a call before that we were talking about Steppen, the thing where you have to walk to get coins. And then somebody made Sexen. And then every time you hit sex, you get coins. And like, I mean, there's certain things in life that you may not want to incentivize that strictly with financial rewards. I shouldn't get a dollar every time I kiss my girlfriend. I should do it because I love her and because I want to. So there's definitely that barrier. But I think that we should, if we want to create better value systems, we should extend the point to what we value and we can financialize much further than we are today. And well, I think especially the younger generation understand it as well.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting point because we had Christopher Goes from Anoma Network, which is a Cosmos Sovereign Zone app chain, where they are basically building privacy shielding technology for private bartering networks, right? And they also want to help people discover, essentially they're trying to solve a coordination problem around preference aggregation, and they're trying to do it with local currency systems, right? And what was really interesting is Chris's take. He has everyone in Cosmos then develops their own really obtuse like abstractions for, because they don't have good concepts to describe what they're trying to do. And one example being Ethan Buckman's sustainability existentialism, which you have to talk to him a bit to understand. And then so Christopher Goes has a really interesting theory around value, right? He talks about how value abstractions with price have led to all kinds of externalities, right, along factors that people don't want, where it makes people say something as vulgar as, well, you're going to go down, you supported Apple, you bought an iPhone, so you don't care about child slavery for cobalt or niobium that much, right? The problem is that all of it is wrapped up in a bundle. You can't just walk up and say, I don't want the child slavery phone, but I would like the one that doesn't have that, right? So he actually thinks that we need to unbundle value in many ways and the value abstractions. And the way we do that is by redefining money. And so one of the things that I think you're really touching on that's interesting is, maybe we curve back to this to close things out, is with, trying to achieve some of these impacts, better worlds, and by defining all the value that it's not being made legible in these systems, right? One of the groups that's trying to kind of do this and at least do an experiment along with you on Colectivo Celo, right? And so they very publicly stated on the record that they want to have a stablecoin treasury backed 40% by natural assets, right? So maybe you could tell us a bit, to the extent that you can, why would someone want to back a stablecoin with natural assets? What would that even look like, right? Like, what is your take on that?
And I take it back all the way to kind of this dollarization and the fact that our currency is backed by dollar. I mean, prior we had harder assets like gold backing currencies. Over time, as banking kind of took over, the US dollar became the strongest currency, and a lot of countries, I think they're 23 right now, had the US dollar as their peg, as their anchor. It's really saying we measure our value relative to their value. And you briefly touched upon earlier as well, kind of how that's very limiting as well for small economies, because we're not able to print more money. We're tied to their value system. They can inflate, we cannot. So
I think that, you know, we went on this somewhat tangent where you really got me thinking about value and how, you know, Christopher Goes at Anoma Network really thinks you have to unbundle value, right? One of the ways that I think is really interesting when you think about like other forms of value is tokenizing nature, natural assets, right? And saying like, hey, you're Collectivo, you're doing that. Celo, at the same time, it's kind of in this universe with you guys, the Celo blockchain has said, hey, we want to back our Celo USD stablecoin 40% with with 40% nature-backed assets, right? And so this is very definitively another form of value, right? And basically, I'm just interested in knowing, what do you think of that in the relative to, you know, how you guys are pegged to the dollar? That's the only value there is.
And so then I was on the right track.
yeah, you were.
Then I was on the right track because currently in crypto, what I wanted to kind of get to is currently in crypto, the majority of people still value their holdings relative to the US dollar. Stable coins are still US dollar. A lot of the things we do are still set around this US dollar concept. I'm forced to watch the Fed's boring video that I don't want to. I don't want to have to care that much about what they decide, what their interest rates are and what so. But the reality is we still are pegged and connected to primarily the dollar as kind of the driver of the crypto space. And Celo, by having their kind of mission as being creating the conditions for prosperity, they're trying to challenge that. They're trying to look at alternative states of the economy where we're not valuing and pegging our money to the dollar, but are valuing and pegging it to these natural assets, to these natural systems, and recognizing that if we want to accomplish stability, we need to have a relationship with nature as well, and not just a relationship with a monetary system like the dollar. And I think in doing that, they're not just spearheading the development of natural assets, because they're essentially creating this honeypot. They're saying, hey, create natural assets, we'll buy them, which truly creates a market. Like it's created like a single-sided market for buying natural assets, which is also one of the main reasons why we with Collectivo are so close with Celo. It's really this combination of this unstoppable commitment, saying 40% of your treasury is an extremely high amount. Framing yourself as wanting to enable the conditions for prosperity is so much further than saying, oh yeah, I want to create impact. Oh, we want to be carbon negative. Yeah, okay, great. No, they have one single purpose, and that is creating the conditions for prosperity. And by saying, hey, we want 40% of our treasury to be backed by natural assets, they're recognizing and respecting that asset class, and they're automatically creating a market for it and really incentivizing groups like ourselves to take on this challenge and say, hey, we think we can do this. We agree with you. We want to accomplish the same goal, creating conditions for prosperity. So that's a clear collaboration there.
Got it. And now I'm going to do something I don't usually do often, but this is something that I think is fun because I did this at Celo Connect, right? The conference in Barcelona with some of the Celo people. I did it with some other folks who are big Celo stands. Not that I'm not, just, you know, where do you think are the pros and cons of a natural asset backed stablecoin, right? Like what are the scenarios that we really have to watch out for, right? Because when I think about a 40% a nature-backed asset class for a stable coin, and then I think about Terra and Luna and all, I'm not putting that in with that, of course, by the way, I'm just saying in general, right? This is what people like stable coins have taken for the forefront, they've come to the forefront, right? We had these conversations at Celo Connect back in March, right? Towards the end of March, the stable coins getting wrecked hadn't happened yet. So I'm curious, you know, to hear like what you've been in this space. You've been CuraDAO, spent early part of your first 10, 15 years of your life there and on Curaçao and had to deal with currency destabilization. What are the cons of potentially experimenting with, you know, a currency or a nature-backed asset stablecoin?
I think the number one con is that we lose the stability because we are pegging to something that the rest of the world does not value similarly to us, where maybe to us, these ecological systems and natural assets are extremely valuable. There then end up maybe only 1,000 people that really think, or maybe 10,000 or 100,000, but definitely not enough of a moat to really recognize that asset class. And then what will happen is that we'll kind of put an end, like it's going to limit our microeconomy. It's going to really continue to be a microeconomy. And within that economy, resources are slowly going to flow. It's almost like a country. We're going to have a limit of import, no limit of export, no new people coming in, no new money coming in. But we need to continue to build and do within that pot. And then essentially we just get drained and then this whole concept would die off and natural assets will continue to just be something we undervalue and destroy if we want for money. On the flip side of that, right, is if we do reach that tipping point that there is a large enough moat of people, investors, backers that recognize that natural assets are valuable and are willing to put their money or at least their value where their mouth is, we can really create regenerative economies in the broadest sense of the world. We can create one big regenerative economy, refi, I would say, that every time that we grow, we create more conditions for further growth in a regenerative way. So we continue to grow. The impact increases. And by every time we do that, we also increase the legitimacy of what we're doing, the legitimacy of the asset class, the legitimacy of our approaches, hopefully until the point where I'd say the majority or maybe a good chunk of the world economy is run in these kind of these complementary regenerative systems, and that they really fill a large part of the gap that we see currently between the current monetary systems and the needs of humans and nature.
Got it. And then like, if I
would add one thing there, John, in terms of the risks. So another risk I would see here is the situation where these natural capital assets have money flowing in. And we've already talked about the ownership issue, to what extent the local natural assets are actually owned by the people that use these natural assets. So whether a forest is used or a stream is used, et cetera. I think one of the things that is not naive, but one of the kind of the outcomes here that could be potentially dangerous is the same sort of thing that we saw with liquidity in emerging market debt, emerging market securities, when money flows back to the center of right now to the US, maybe to the euro in the future or to the yuan. But to the extent that there's not appropriate staking mechanisms to ensure that people can't get money out quickly, I would worry about a situation as well where the local resource could either be voted to be sold to an evil actor or a state actor, where effectively the local population, and the local population might do this, right? Like this happened in Russia in the 90s. And so the local population might say, hey, we don't care that the water supply of China, of Curaçao is owned by China. That doesn't seem like a big deal. We're going to all, sell the stake and move to the US. So that would be another area where I would think like the staking around this would have to be very well thought out. And it also brought up the idea of, it'd be interesting to the extent that you could kind of put a lat long tag on money so that you could geofence money within economies. I don't know if anyone's working on that.
Yes.
It's funny you say that.
So I have so many thoughts. Thanks for bringing this up. So maybe let me start by the part of ownership of local assets, which is a big challenge, especially in the Caribbean. Foreigners buy the beaches, which are the most valuable property. One of the parts in the Colectivo framework that we're optimizing for is not selling physical ownership of a location, but really selling the MRV data, kind of the impact credits, the CO2 sequestration, the yields from that location, but not the location itself, because we want to avoid kind of what happened already on the island with foreigners controlling certain key areas of the island, which also we think is not, I think this whole concept of ownership is also slowly shifting in a broader society. We don't have to own everything as long as we can reap the benefits from it. So you can reap the benefits from a Curaçao food forest. You can get all the data. You can get all the benefits. You can get the fruits and vegetables. You can get the impact we created, but you're not going to get the land. Not saying that we would never tokenize land or tokenize an asset or whatsoever, but in general, that's not what we're optimizing for. Another point there is the way we approach Colectivo is as a global network where local communities will have their own reserve, which will be a composition of assets that they deem valuable. So, and this kind of goes back maybe to the asset management side of me, is that we don't expect people to be completely backed by natural assets or completely backed by KNT or completely backed by one specific thing. This kind of, again, why we think locality is so important, because we believe local communities should be able to decide for themselves what assets they deem valuable. Maybe they want some tokenized gold in there or physical gold. Who am I to stop them? And So in relation to that, I think that it is extremely important that these natural assets are managed well. And it also means that, one, you don't let people take complete ownership of your local island or local nation or just the physical ground, but also that you don't see them as a silver bullet, for this is the only valuable thing and we should close our eyes to all the other value systems. It would probably still contain a healthy reserve, would probably today still contain 20, 30, 40, 50% US dollars, because that's just the state that we're in. But in a worst case, if the thing completely collapses, there's still value that the local community recognizes. And maybe the rest of the world doesn't, but to them, it still means a lot. So that's maybe another kind of, again, a cultural thing, why these regenerative systems are so exciting to me, is the worst thing that will happen is that the economy explodes, but then at least we created all these positive things and we've benefited so many lives. So yeah, I think that that's why the locality is so important, and the management side as well.
And since Martin brought it up, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what y'all are doing with geospatial NFTs, because I think that the what Martin brought up too, like, Martin, if you feel free to chime in too and explicate further if you want, but what was, I believe we talked with David about this too, the idea that basically you could geofence a new currency with a lat long tied to an NFT that basically, as you get further and away for, as you get further away from that center where a community has issued that currency and kind of said, hey, you know, keep it here, increase the money velocity here, make sure that it's the throughput in the economy increases in this general region. As you get further away from that region, the money's purchasing power might decrease, right? So that's roughly what the idea is we talked with David. So what is your take on that?
Yeah, I think it again goes down to these localities, but also the flexibility that we have now with digitization of almost any asset. I would assume that even within a local community currency, there may be sub-economies that are either creating their own assets or their own tokens or their own value systems that run in parallel or as part of this bigger local system. But I think that's the number one, or like the biggest innovation in crypto in general, is now anybody can make their own money. And it can be overstated enough kind of how big of an innovation that is. I have the freedom to create my own value system. And if I find other people that share a similar value system, we can coordinate value through that system. It sounds very simple, but it's such a big revelation that allows for, I think it goes back to kind of what you were describing earlier, segregating values, allowing for different groups of values to be valued as they are instead of one big block. Because essentially now we get one big, here, this is a dollar. It takes everything into account. Take it or leave it. There's no alternative. And I think if we give communities the resources to create these smaller economies that they are heavily connected to, they'll be able to be more productive and be able to create these systems better.
Cool, man. I think like we're kind of reaching the end of the, you know, we kind of traced the path through your work in, you know, you grew up where you grew up, your experience as an asset manager, your experiences in DAOs, a natural asset tokenization. We hit on a lot of things there. I think maybe the last thing we touch on here is, which you didn't get into that much, but you've kind of alluded to here and there, is the other big thread that runs through a lot of Web3 impact groups, and the ones even that you're involved in, is a focus on Eleanor Ostrom's, you know, governing the commons and these nine, but I'll fix it in the show notes if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. Prince, I'm being told that it's eight. I've just been yanked from the stage. But anyway, there are eight principles, commons governance. And so I'm curious to know, just not with respect to Ostrom, just in general, how are you folks thinking of the governance of the entity of Collectivo, and then one level down and, you know, across all the groups who may use the currency systems that are either issue a currency or build one on top of Collectivo? How are you thinking about governance in this institution as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, governance is such a hard topic, but a nice thing about DAOs is that we're able to iterate extremely fast on our governance assumptions. The way we're looking at the system now is really in a multi-tier governance system, where the kind of biggest, most supranational entity would be the Collectivo network itself with its treasury, which would primarily focus on the kind of macroeconomic policymaking and maintaining stability in the network. And then from there, you have these local instances of Collectivo, the Collectivo Curaçao, maybe the Collectivo Trinidad, the Collectivo whatever, and making sure that the more granular you go, the more local governance you have and the less global input you have. So the global thing will be mainly responsible for operating a functional framework and developing that and running it in a good way. But then on the local level, those people should not be able to decide what my community should fund or what we should do or what values we want to represent. So really separating those two instances from each other, which is something I see happening not at all in most current DAOs, where there's just monolithic system for all governance decisions under a financialized token as well. So really going more granular when it comes to governance. And the way we're seeing it now on the local level is mainly three different ways. Number one is almost like a token created registry or like a snapshot of what people want and want to represent. Here we imagine more of like a one person, one vote or one person, same amount of votes system, where based on your identity as a person, you get an amount of votes that you can allocate to specific impact areas that you deem relevant for the island, for the community, which is then going to inform the wider ecosystem which initiatives should be prioritized in a more of a directive approach. So the first one is ask everybody, today, how are you feeling? What do you think we need more of? Or every quarter, every whatever. Maybe they say, hey, we think we need more technical development. Maybe they say, hey, we don't need food. We just need technology. Great. Now from there, we go a layer deeper where we have more expertise and more curation and guidance. We call them stewards, impact stewards. So those are people that have proven on the ground to be able to steward and direct resources towards outcomes. And there, those people will be making more decisions in their respective domains to make sure that we have a combination of more like a democratic system where everybody has a voice. Mm-hmm. So everybody has a voice, but not everybody has a vote. So certain people have more decision-making capabilities than others in specific regions. However, that is all still tied together in one fabric that the majority can control or overrule if they feel that certain aspects or areas or people are misusing the system. And then finally, there's the monetary aspect that will also have a combination in this case of most likely locals and domain experts that will collaborate on the maintenance of these economies. So the majority will probably be local. However, we do think that it's critical to have some domain knowledge being spread around the different colectivos. So you could imagine that you have some sort of a rotating system where every monetary system needs at least 30% of other collective monetary stewards in there as well, or something like that.
Got it.
This is something that assumptions, or not really assumptions, but like best guesses from the experiments of the past years. But we'll probably see a lot of exploration and development in this area specifically.
No, that makes sense. And what I think is interesting about it too is that it goes away. There's some really rote and vulgar criticisms of anyone who wants to do anything other than one token, one vote.
Yeah, and I would add to that, I think the challenge is that each of these resources, I mean, if we go back to Ostrom's framework, the people that should have the right to vote, the people that should have the right to governance should be the ones that are actually using the resource, right? And so you really need to be geo-fenced or kind of from an impact perspective on the ground, where wealth is being directed. It really needs to be, the governance really needs to be tied to those that are actually participatory. Otherwise, you get into this framework that we have today, and most of these Web3 projects where 90% of people actually don't participate in governance, even though they've been given the right. And so I think community expectations is another area where that needs to be kind of part of the system is, well, how do you want to participate? Like, do you actually want to participate? And what do you want to get out of the system? There's really good recent work on this on kind of over the past year, and I'll put it in the show notes, on, you know, closed ecosystems where you have the right to participate, and how even though that right to participate in governance has been afforded to you, the expectations that you had coming into that ecosystem, and this could be a digital cooperative, it could be, you know, an island, it could be, you know, managing a local resource, whatever the ecosystem that you have some governance over, those expectations coming in are really important to segregate in order to not have this kind of one size fits all governance model that doesn't match up to how people actually want to participate. So I know we've talked about that kind of ad nauseum, but that's another area where I'd be interested to see how this all evolves, Luke.
And I think one concept that really aligns to that is the decentralization aspect of DAOs. especially in these smaller local economies, there is a risk to voting. It's a social pressure, a social risk. So currently most votes on chain are transparent, which works perfectly fine if you're voting with a guy on the other side of the island, of the world, on a mobile game, but becomes more serious if you are voting on something serious about your neighbor and your neighbor sees that you do that. Therefore, kind of this concept of a DAO, like decentralized autonomous organization. In the early days, we were very purist. We would always debate around the terms DAO. But I think decentralization is just very practical on the ground. It creates resiliency. It creates also shared ownership. There's no longer one person in charge, and therefore also no longer one person to blame or to convert or whatso. The autonomy part for me as an islander is to a good chunk enabling human prosperity and enabling communities to be self-sufficient and resilient. Autonomous for me means less about automated code. Yeah, that's a part of it. But to me, it becomes more of the act of becoming more autonomous by engaging in this kind of DAO structure. And then finally, the organization part is, I think, where a lot of the current impact initiatives and alternatives just lack is this, the extra value that organizing in general opens up and the way you can coordinate just so much more efficiently. To me, that's really why the kind of the DAO approach is the way to go.
But great. Thanks, Luke. I think that really wraps up. It's like the home stretch of what we wanted to cover with you, man. Really appreciate your time. The very last thing we like to let every person do when they're honest to basically, especially you coming from the world that you do, is please, Phil, take this opportunity to tell everyone where they can find you, Collectivo, stay up on the project and follow your progress.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So Collectivo with a K on Twitter, LinkedIn, any boomer platform. We're also on Instagram if you're hip, or TikTok, I think we're even on. You can find us there, collectivo.co also. But even better, if you are interested in coming over to Curaçao to experiment and explore this yourself, we're hosting a big innovation festival, two-day innovation festival on the island on October 21st and 22nd of this year. We'll gather about 1,500 people, both locals and people from abroad. And we'll have presentations, workshops, food stands. And we'll pilot the Collectivo wallet. It will really be a nice celebratory moment. You'll be on a nice Caribbean island for a week. You're going to have a great time, boat parties, everything. So if you're interested, we're going live. We actually went live just before today with the first announcement. You can get your tickets online already now. We're also circulating an event guide, so you have all the information about how to get to the island, where to stay, and what so. So if you're really interested, that's the best way to get involved. Come over to the island. It's right after DEF CON. They're very cheap and easy flights from Colombia to Curaçao, only 2.5 hours-ish. So if you're either going to DEF CON or you feel like, hey, this is something I want to be part of this experiment, come over to Curaçao October 21st and 22nd.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Luke. Very much appreciate your time. Thanks for walking us through what y'all are doing over there at Collectivo. It's fascinating stuff. I can't wait to see where it lands this year.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.